I'm Channel 2, full-time, 105.7 The Fan, sometimes Masson. It's good to see everybody tonight, and I'm probably excited about this as you are because I got to Baltimore in 1980, and Eddie was just getting rolling. He had 3-4 years under his belt, and then got to see Cal. I remember interviewing Cal right before his first game, and he said, I'm a little nervous because, you know, I'm from around here. So we found out, yeah, he was from around here and still is, so should be a fun night, and we're going to let you have some input in this thing too, so if you have any questions for Cal or Eddie, you'll get a chance to ask those. We'll move around the room tonight. I wrote down a couple of notes here before we introduce these two. You know, my job is to introduce two guys who need no introduction, so that's a tough job, but together they represent the best of Orioles baseball. These two teammates and first ballot Hall of Famers combined to play 6,027 games. They hit 935 homers and drove in 3,612 runs. They're both Rookies of the Year, Gold Glove winners. Their accomplishments include league and all-star MVP awards. Their names are sprinkled throughout Major League Baseball's record books. They were teammates for 8 years and were the leaders of the 1983 World Championship Orioles. So let's introduce these two. This Oriole spent 13 seasons in Baltimore. In 96, he joined Hank Aaron and Willie Mays as the only players in history with 500 homers and 3,000 hits. He's an 8-time All-Star with 3 Gold Gloves. He was as steady as they come. 8 times he finished in the top 8 in MVP voting. 7 times he was voted Most Valuable Oriole. He had at least 75 RBI in each of his first 20 seasons. 16 seasons, he played at least 150 games, and he was money in the clutch. In 238 bats with the bases loaded, he hit .399. His 19 grand slams are third all-time. The Orioles have retired his number 33, and we'll never forget the roaring chants that you made of Eddie at Memorial Stadium. Ladies and gentlemen, Eddie Murray. Looks like he can still play, doesn't he? Okay, next up, a 19-time All-Star who played his entire 21-year career in Baltimore. This Hall of Famer had the highest vote for any position player in Cooperstown history. A 2-time MVP and 2-time All-Star MVP. He was Rookie of the Year in 1982. The next year, he was American League MVP and grabbed the final out in the World Series win in Philadelphia. September 6, 1995 was voted baseball's all-time best moment. That's the night we watched him break Lou Gehrig's unbreakable record with consecutive game number 2,131. He got a 22-minute standing ovation that night. We don't have that much time here tonight, but ladies and gentlemen, welcome Cal Ripken Jr.
I could take a lap around this little room.
Before we get into it with Cal and Eddie, I'd like to introduce the executive director of Sports Legends Museum and the Sports Legends and Babe Ruth Museum, Mike Gibbons, for a few words. Michael?
All right. Thank all of you for coming down tonight. This is a very special night. We don't get these guys too often in our town since their playing days, and I want to thank both of you for being here to benefit the museum and to help us as we carry on the tradition of Baltimore sports here at Sports Legends at Camden Yards. Let me just go over a little bit of what's going to happen for the rest of the evening. We're going to be doing this fireside chat for about 45 minutes or so, and then after that, Scott and Cal and Eddie Eddie will be stepping out, and then we're going to ask you to go back out into the lobby, and you can have drinks and eat a little more. We urge you to go over and take a look at the silent auction, which will be open until 8:30 tonight. And then we're going to queue you up to have your pictures taken with Cal and Eddie, and everybody has a piece of paper with a number on it, and we're going to be calling numbers in groups of 20. So 1 through 20 will start, so you can start to see where you're going to fall. And that will happen back in the gentleman's waiting room where part of the reception was this evening. So you go out into the lobby, and then we'll queue you up to go in and have your photos taken, and then you'll be able to come back into the reception or vacate through our store. So, but thank you all for being here. Special night. I hope we will see a bunch of you back here two nights from now for the Babe Ruth birthday bash. So with that said, I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Garcelle.
Thank you, Mike. Well, where do you start with these two? I thought it would be interesting to find out, Cal, your first impression. Eddie gets here in 1977. You arrived at the end of the 81 season. But what was your first impression of Eddie Murray?
It was kind of funny. Ed did come up and play for Dad in Asheville, but I think I was gone by that time. I don't have any nightmares from meeting Ed at that time. But I played down in the city in summer of 77 for Putty Hill Optimist. I was 16, turning 17 that summer. And so I would drop my dad off. Part of my routine was to drop him off at the ballpark, take the car and go play a game, and then come back at the end of the game. So I was hanging around the ballpark a little bit more. And Reggie was there that summer, wasn't he? What was Reggie's summer?
76.
Was it 76?
I believe. Yeah.
I believe you, Eddie.
That doesn't sound right to me. But I do remember Al Bumby was really friendly, and every time I came in and my uniform was dirty, you know, he'd say, "Oh, Bubba had a great game," and he'd all be all loud and congratulate me, and he made me feel really good. Eddie was kind of quiet, and finally I got a chance to work up my nerve to go over to say something to Eddie, and he stared at me, and I turned around and walked the other way.
I know that look, Eddie.
But, you know,
comment about
it. The only thing I'll say about that is the funny part about that is Eddie has the meanest look that you ever want to see on anyone, you know, and he has the ability to stop you in your tracks, which I've felt. But he has the biggest heart, so you just have to break through that first look. And then once you do, he pulls you in. And he was really nice to me, and so was Eddie and all those guys. So first impression was, you know, Dad loved him, you know, and when Dad tells you that he's a great, special person, that's all you need.
Eddie, from your standpoint, obviously Cal Sr. had a big impact on you, but what do you remember of this kid when he first started showing up?
No, we all acknowledge it.
It is working, or isn't it?
Okay, they should hear.
Yeah.
We all acknowledge that he would come back from the ball games all dirty and everything, but see, I know a lot of guys used to... This kid, either he's not a good hitter because he's always having to slide. That's the way I feel about it. He's a fast runner, but it was always good. At that time, I had pretty much all the kids on the team. They used to gravitate towards me. So, you know, he was a little taller than most, but he was still one of, you know, the one of the younger kids. And we always gave him a little jab here and there. And, you know, that's just how it was.
You guys did things for years that made us ooh and ah and marvel at your ability to play the game. What's one or two things that you saw Eddie do where you went, wow?
Well, I mean, anytime somebody made Ed mad, if they threw up around his head, he had this look on his face, and all of a sudden his concentration went to another level, and you knew something special was going to happen. Normally it was a home run, normally it was a big hit, or sometimes the pitcher just got scared and walked him. But that was an everyday occurrence. And I think, we all that know Ed really clearly, you don't want to wake Ed up at all. If he's struggling a little bit, let him kind of keep struggling. Don't do anything that will change that. But the most remarkable thing I've ever seen Ed do was in the trip in 84. We went to Japan. And we were over in Japan, and along those same lines, the Japanese pitchers were scouting us a little bit, and they had a scouting report on myself that said I dove out to the outside corner and covered the plate, so you had to get them out, up and in. You had to stop them from diving. And the same with Eddie. Eddie would sit down in there and really cover the outside part of the plate, so you had to go up and in. Now, their control wasn't the best, so even in an exhibition sort of series, we got knocked down quite a bit. Both of us were getting kind of pissed off that this was happening. And sure enough, Eddie comes up, and the guy throws up around Eddie's head, and Eddie just has that blank stare again, kind of looks out at him, and then Eddie, for the next pitch, kind of went into a Rod Carew sort of stance. You know, if you can picture Rodney Carew, he just kind of went in like this, like he didn't care, and just kind of took the pitch, and that pitch was really outside. Now it was 2-0. And then he went back in that stance again, but as the pitcher got ready to throw, he kind of cranked back up again, and he hit the longest home run I've ever seen. Straightaway center field, I was on first base, started to run, and I don't know what the measurement was, but it kept going and going and going. And then it cleared the stadium, and it landed in the thing. And now Eddie is in his home run trot, and he has a certain level of contentment that he did what he was going to do. But he still had this ugly look on his face, and he was mad. And he's coming around, and he was met at home plate by someone dressed formally like a geisha girl in the home plate, which gave him a stuffed Mickey Mouse. And so he had to carry the Mickey Mouse thing back to the dugout with him. That softened it a little bit, but he still didn't want to smile.
Hit the longest home run of your life, and you got Mickey Mouse, right?
Well, I don't think it was the longest one. The longest one I hit was in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm just starting to hit left-handed for the first full year. We're playing the Pirates AAA team. At this rate, I've only pulled maybe 2-3 left-handed home runs. Well, I pulled another one this particular night. Train happened to be going by in right field. Landed so pretty in the cold. It just kept on. Now, I'm running around the bases. Now I'm starting to turn around. All I could think of was, oh, don't hit me. I don't know how I'm looking. You know, I'm thinking about, I'm galloping like Ted Williams when he hit his home run. But this ball is just so pretty. And I'm turning around, and I'm supposed to be going in that direction, and I'm just turning around watching the ball go. So I have no idea how far I hit that one.
It's still going.
Yeah, that one was pretty.
All right, you both were managed by Earl Weaver. Your thoughts on Earl, and anything jump out from the Weaver years?
Hey, you go first, Ed.
I couldn't have had a better manager, I think, my first year. I got a couple stories maybe I can tell you real quick to show you how a relationship worked. First time we actually said hi was probably in the middle of July. He didn't say anything to me, and I was a youngster around there, so he didn't say anything. Everything you heard was, shut up, rookie, you know. Shut up around there. So I never forget the, we're checking out, and Earl is putting the paper that I'm going north. Now, him and Hank Peters are fighting. They're fighting. Earl, the kid has to go to his team. Earl's telling him the kid's team might be here with us. He sits there and argues. He says something to Earl, and Earl goes, all I know is I played him the last 2 days. He hit 2 doubles. It drove in 4 runs and had 5 hits or something. He said, I'm playing him again. So this goes on for about 4 days again. Now they're having that little meeting. This one's saying I got to get to my team. This one's saying this team might be here. So I finally hit a ball over the center field wall in Straightaway Center in Miami. I think I was the fourth guy to ever do that. And they were putting the paper that I was going north. So we're going north. We have to wear ties on our flights. We're in a little Avis room that's approximately from that wall to here. And we have a whole ball club in here. Everybody has on their ties. It's about 94 degrees and humid. There's not one player that's not sweating. And Earl looks around and sees I'm the only one not with a tie. And he just attacked. Right on what your means I like here. He's looking up at me.
Why are you sitting down?
So he looks up at me.
Where's your tie?
And I didn't say a word. I just stared at him in the face. I reached in my pocket and went. And the thing was, he looked at me and he went and told somebody. This kid's not smart. I mean, he's pretty smart. He should all the rest of us have got this all tied up in his 94 degrees. He's the one that's waiting until the last moment to put it on. You know, that was kind of funny. And then the other one was Doug DeSensei is my locker mate. I'm the last one, or the first one that you come to the locker room. So as soon as we get up to Baltimore, Doug goes, uh-oh. I go, what? He said, that's not a good locker. I said, why is that? He said, nobody can stay in there long. I said, don't worry, I'll hold it down for a while. So we go to play, and it's about the middle of July, and this is our first time we've said hello. I'm hearing spikes in the tunnel, and, you know, it's Earl coming this way, so he stopped and he goes, and I keep right on going. But that's the first time we said hi. Now I hear spikes in the back of me that were walking, you know, and it's Doug. So he stops Doug, and it's, you know, I can hear the spikes stop. But he stopped Doug back there, and he goes, hey, what about that kid? Doug goes, well, what makes you think he talks to me just because there's a locker next to me? You know, it was just at a time where, you know, you tried to be seen and not heard, and, you know, Earl and all of these guys, I swear I wouldn't have traded my first 8 years in for anything. It was awesome having him around, and, you know, I could tell you another story. George, you might remember this one. I got real smart one night. I'm trying to steal third base. There's two outs in the last inning. Yeah. I got thrown out. Hey, get in my office. And they said, some reason they called me his son. Oh, he's going to get him now. Oh, boy. So I headed to the office back there with Earl. As soon as I sit down, he says, get out of here. So as I get out, out the chair, and I'm walking out. Now I go over to open the door. Now half the team's about to fall in. But that was just a funny little story.
That's Earl. Cal, how about you?
Well, Earl talked to me a lot of times in the first part of my career because I was 3 for 5. I was 3 for 5 opening day, and then I was 4 for my next 64. And so it was an everyday occurrence that Earl was calling me into his office, and he didn't just say, get out of here. He tried to support you and say, you know, hey, we traded Doug DeSensei away. We made room for you. Just relax and be yourself. I'm not going to send you back. I'm not going to send you back to AAA. Just go out and play like you can play. And that didn't work for the first while, and then he started screaming on me. Trying to motivate me that way. And then he got an idea that he was going to take me out for early batting practice. I had early batting practice at 2 o'clock every day for the first month of the season. And he went out there and stood on the top of the batting cage behind, and so he could see. He couldn't see over the top of it. My dad was out there throwing batting practice to me, and the first pitch was in the outside corner. You know, the first round of BP, I was just thinking, okay, so I hit a line drive to right field. The next pitch was on the outside corner again, hit a line drive to right field. And by the time the third pitch was out there, I'm thinking, okay, there's a pattern here. Something was going on. And Earl was sitting there watching. So Earl thought I couldn't cover the outside corner, so he told my dad to throw the ball every pitch of batting practice in the outside corner, and my dad could. And so I leaned out there to the outside corner after I started realizing, I started anticipating it was going to be out in the outside corner, and I started driving the ball to out of the ballpark in left center field. And so then he goes, okay, that's enough. I guess you can cover the outside corner. And he walked away. And shortly thereafter, I started to get a few hits, started to build my confidence, and got out of it. And right when I started to get my feet on the ground at third base, he decided he was going to move into shortstop without even telling me. You know, one day I came in and I saw a 6 next to my name instead of the normal 5 that represented third base, and I had just assumed he had too much to drink the night before. But I went in there, and he put me at short. And when I think of Earl, Earl really had a way understanding people. I mean, he didn't care if you really liked him. You know, he wanted to motivate you, and he tried. And really getting past all that other stuff that Earl did, he really was knowledgeable about his baseball team. He helped pick his baseball team. He managed, you know, for the long haul. And he was really a joy and a pleasure to play for.
Eddie, we all know Cal's influence on his career and yours for that matter, but would you talk a little bit about growing up in Southern California and growing up in a competitive family and the influence your brothers had on you and developing you into a Hall of Fame baseball player?
Well, I still think a lot of times that the toughest thing I did in life was play in my yard with my brothers and sisters.
Did they beat the crap out of you? Especially your sisters?
No. It wasn't a whole lot of that in our house. See, my brother started a stupid rule. If anybody in the family, like the brothers or you fighting the sister or whatever, if anybody cried, then you both got your butts whipped. So here it is, you go in the attic one day, and we got to see this live one day, and I'm messing with my brother Richie, and I got him in the headlock, and I got him down. Now all of a sudden, I know I'm kind of hurting him, and you know, and I stop. Now he gets up, and his eyes are loaded with water. I said, hold your head back. No, no, no. My family, but in growing up in that family, we played in the yard, and we had a game. Me and my younger brother hit a lot of pitchers growing up because of the games we played in the yard. Back in the day, you used to have a garage where the car, you could drive it straight on back up into the garage. Well, the garage then went left. Well, to only score a run, you had to hit the ball straight back through. So if you touch any part of the garage, it was just a strike. I don't care how hard you hit it. Well, we had gotten so good at hitting the ball back up the middle. Pitchers, if you made us mad somehow, we would hit you. We did a lot of this, but in playing with my brothers, you did not want to be out there stuck pitching. But, you know, and I let them know every day that I appreciated that they did not let us win. Let us compete with them. I mean, we had to go out and find a way to get it done. And I still think it helped me to the, you know, well, still to the day you see kids or you see somebody hitting and you'll just go, ooh, like he can't hit this or he can't handle that. Or, you know, and it was amazing at how I used that stuff in the yard, how we used it. We had baseballs. We couldn't play with baseballs or tennis balls or dolls' heads. We had to keep reinventing games in our house because if we hit the house, the clock fell down. If the clock fell down, someone had to go do chores, so that messed up the game. So you would switch over, and like I said, we start snatching our sister's dolls' heads, and we'd go out and play. Now we found out that the hair would stop the flight of the ball a little bit. In about 6 months, we were now driving that doll's head into the house. Clock falls down. The game's broken.
Can I make a DVD with you?
Well, I've been trying to get Ozzy to do it because he tells his Wonder Bag how he used to always keep his glove in a Wonder Bag. You know, a loaf of bread. You know, he had to let it sleep in there.
Okay.
It worked for him, yeah.
You were teammates with Ozzy in high school?
Since I was nine.
Yeah.
Yeah, since I was nine.
Parallel.
Yeah, we graduated the same year. Missed going in the hall by 1 year.
When did you realize he had that special talent that we saw from him with the glove?
Yeah. He was 10, I was 9. I recognized he had it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we saw things. You think of hitting the balls that were hit through a third baseman's legs, and as he hasn't pulled his legs up and, like, don't really want to look up because he let it roll through his legs, next thing you know, the ball's coming out of the hole, and it was Ozzy throwing the ball over, getting the guy out at first. You had no idea as a kid how much range he had on the other side of second base. And, I mean, we're seeing all of this. I come here to Baltimore, and Belanger did something one day. And he said, Ed, it is so great pitch with that guy. He's the greatest shortstop I've ever seen. Didn't comment. So Rudy said, Ed, did you hear me? I said, yeah. What, you think somebody's better?
I said, well, I know a friend. I grew up with him. I said, he's pretty good. San Diego just drafted him. I said, he's not in the big leagues yet. He'll probably be there next year. Rudy gets traded back to the National League. Ozzie's up there. And the play he made off of Horner was when he dove out. The ball took a bat hop. He barehanded it. Hit the ground like that, was up and throwing him out. I saw this as kids. You know, this was, I mean, we were trying to tell everybody that this kid was really that good. And he was just an unbelievable athlete. He actually could hit then, and then he started to listen to everybody. And he went on a little couple of years span where he didn't swing the bat well with San Diego. And finally, I had to grab him and talk to him and say, stop listening to everybody, you know. Yeah. Because sometimes you try and please people in this game, and you can't please everybody. And you try and tell him sometimes you got to learn to do this, but inside you're going.
Did he teach you the backflip?
No. I heard the Bill Cosby album, Your Butt Doesn't Belong Over Your Head.
If you have a question for either guy, we'll get you guys involved here.
Thanks, Scott. When you guys were growing up, who were your heroes, not family? And now that you're adult, who do you admire and who are your heroes?
Don't say each other.
Well, mine, the guy that I grew up around here, and everybody loved Brooks Robinson. I mean, Brooksy was the man on the team that had a lot of great players. But Brooksy was out in the community. I think a lot of the parents, you know, with the younger kids would point Brooksy out for a lot of reasons. But, you know, I've still, all these years, I've never found anyone to say a bad word about Brooksy. And that's pretty remarkable. You just keep hearing story after story after story. So Brooksy was a guy I tried to emulate growing up. And you know, now you mean, is there someone in the anybody? I have to let Eddie answer the first part of the question so I can think about the second part.
We were very knowledgeable growing up in my house about baseball. And when I got inducted to the Hall of Fame, the one thing I loved most was watching those guys talk to my sisters. Because my sisters were talking with them and telling them about their stats and stuff of that nature. And that was really a cool thing to me. You know, because, like I said, I wish two of them were boys. So they could have maybe played alongside of us. They were that good. I would say, you know, you knew of Hank Aaron, Willie Mays. These guys were there. But, you know, all those guys are like role models or you looked up to them. But I always gave my oldest brother that prop, because if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have played. And that's still, you know, how I feel today.
How long before there was any talk of you being an Iron Man? You played in the longest game in professional baseball history, the 33-inning game against Pawtucket when you were in Rochester. Would it take 3 days to finish it? Give us your thoughts about that whole deal.
Was the uniform dirty?
Real dirty. Three uniforms.
And no, the uniform wasn't dirty because I was 1-for-12 that night. But I got a hit in the top of the 33rd and made it 2-for-13. That was much better. It was cold in Pawtucket. The wind was blowing in 1,000 miles an hour. Pawtucket was sort of...
You guys weren't getting a lot of hits. We know you were cold.
Yes. It was a bandbox, and it was a pitcher's duel. We had a 1-0 lead going into that game. And one of the guys pinch hit, the guy hit a triple that we thought was really gone, and he ended up on third base. They pinch hit a guy by the name of Russ Larrabee, and he hit a sack fly to score the run and tied it up. And so he stayed in the game. He didn't play for the first 8 innings, but he stayed in the game, and he went on to strike out 7 straight times after that. I guess that was the curse for tying up the game. But we played, we scored one in the 21st, they scored one in the bottom of the 21st, and then it went on. And at 4:07 in the morning, the umpires decided that it was it was canceled or suspended. And I guess
last call that night, right?
No, but I mean, there was a bunch of funny stories that came by. There was a pitcher that came home after the game, and it was early in the morning, and his wife wouldn't let him in. Evidently, it wasn't the first time he came home. But he did say, he goes, honey, the game just ended. And he had no credibility on that. But it was true, and we did resume the game some months later, we didn't score in the top of the 33rd, and they scored in the bottom of the 33rd one game or so. I didn't know any better. I mean, it's part of being a minor leaguer that you just keep playing. And so in many ways, it's not like after you've had a little while in baseball, you kind of look back and go, what an accomplishment it was. You just kept playing. You know, you didn't think you were doing anything new. You know, it was just really weird and kind of strange. Never been in that situation before, but you kept trying to win the game and kept playing. It got so cold that... you know, Mark Corey, you remember Mark Corey? He actually got taken out for defensive replacement. He went in and had too many beers inside the clubhouse, passed out on the heater, woke up and found out that we were still playing the game. And that everybody was tearing up the parts of the bench, you know, so nobody could sit down anymore so they could burn it in the fire to stay warm. So they had a bucket, a barrel there. So we were taking, and there was 12 people that stayed all the way through the game until 4:07. I think they were awarded with season tickets, but, you know, we didn't know any better. We were just playing baseball.
Wade Boggs was in that game as well, right?
Boggs, yeah. Boggs, he was in the game, yep. There was Bruce Hurst was in the game. Okay. There was a lot of big leaguers from Boston for sure that was in that game.
They figured if you guys could go 33, you could play in the big leagues probably. Who else? Question? Here we go.
What one player who's eligible that's not in the Hall of Fame do you think deserves to be in the Hall of Fame?
Eddie, you've been in the Hall of Fame longer than me thinking about this question.
Well, I don't think a whole lot about things I don't control, and he'll tell you that. Jim Rice is probably a guy, and he's in there now. So, I don't know about Dawson's numbers or, you know, you sit there and you look at Blylevin, and he's trying to get in there, and I'm going, it's probably my fault that I kept him out. You know? I remember...
I contributed really well, too.
I remember one year I ended with two swings. I hit a home run off him. Then my next two swings, he opened up the All-Star break, and we were still playing Minnesota. First two times I swung, so it's three successive swings that I, you know, kind of got this guy, and I kind of liked him, but, you know. So maybe that's holding him back a little bit.
Jim Rice was the first immediate answer up until this year because when you think of Jim Rice, and I don't look at the numbers and try to analyze the longevity of someone's career and kind of to make a case for how long they did it. You know, I immediately think about in their time in the All-Star game, and I was very fortunate to go to many All-Star games, but Jim Rice was the man at that All-Star game that hit fourth. And he was the one that was most comfortable, and he was the one leading the league in home runs. He was an offensive force that in the game of All-Stars, he was sitting right there in the middle of the lineup. He didn't get a lot of credit for his defense, although he played the left field fence pretty well. And there were some other intangibles that he brought to the table, but he was a feared hitter. And therefore, when you look at everybody else, I like Don Mattingly a lot. And for whatever reason, his career ended. You know, he's penalized by that. Maybe it was back injury, maybe there was some personal issues that he had, which we're not 100% sure of, but also he was the guy that was dominant through that time, a good two-way player, great first baseman, great thinker of the game, great hitter, was a slap hitter when he came up, and then all of a sudden decided he was going to hit home runs and drive in runs, and he did that. And his stats, really, if you look at them, I think are accumulative like Kirby Puckett's stats, and Kirby Puckett's career ended, you know, like that. He was brought in. I don't think Mattingly was ever part of a World Series team, which I don't know why that's totally relevant, but Mattingly certainly. And the other one that I'm thinking about is Jack Morris. You know, Jack Morris, there was a good rivalry. You know, we loved to scream at him. Eddie loved to scream at him and get him upset. And we hit him pretty well, you know, as a team. But I think Jack... Jack was a, I mean, he was single-handedly responsible for two World Series.
Yeah.
Toronto and Minnesota. And so he pitched them through the game 1, 4, and 7. So I don't know what Jack's numbers are overall. But to me, he was that sort of gamer that you wanted a big big pitch on.
Well, I got a story reason why he's probably not in there. I'll tell it in a moment. But Jack, I had a chance of really hitting a lot of home runs off a guy, and it was him. Then he came up with that splitter, and he told me, he says, at least you're standing on one of the bases instead of touching them all. I hit a couple of them off him just kind of quick, and he's the guy that really made me feel like, this is fun. This is going to be fun. Jack was on the mound one day, and I'm just hitting him real good, and he comes up with this splitter. And the first time he goes, and I stepped out and I went, oh, this is me and you. It's not you. You know, we kind of looked at each other, and, you know, it was a nice little battle for a long time, me and him against each other. And the reason why I'll say that Jack maybe wasn't voted in yet, I played with him in Cleveland, and he was crying on the mound one day. Not a good thing. Not a close-up.
So crying in baseball is not allowed.
No crying in baseball. No crying.
The Murray family earned that early, right? That's a family trait. You guys made it to the Hall of Fame and dominated more pitchers than dominated you, but who was the one guy for each of you that you had the most trouble with?
My guy, all those guys liked. I just didn't like them for not getting him out of the game soon enough. Roger Erickson threw the ball right down the middle. I said, there's no way a guy can throw each pitch, every pitch he had, right down the middle of the plate. And somehow, I don't know if I was looking on this corner or that corner, but somehow Roger's ball was flying in the middle of the plate, and I was hitting ground balls a second. And I didn't do a whole lot of yelling, but I would yell, won't you guys get him out of here, you know? He's trying to get me to do good things, and I just wasn't getting it done.
Now, you didn't strike out a lot, I'm going to ask you, but was there anybody that struck you out a lot that felt like he was throwing an invisible ball up there that when you went to swing at it?
Believe it or not, I got Bruce Hurst in my book a lot. I don't never have like Bruce Hurst. I think I hit my 300th home run. I think I hit my, when I broke the Oriole record, it was off of Bruce. There was another RBI or something with Bruce. Every time I did something, it was Bruce, but I hated him.
Okay, I got one from the past that you couldn't hit when you first came up, and you solved it a little bit, but it was Oil Can Boyd.
Oh.
Oil Can Boyd, you could not hit with a paddle.
There's not a whole lot of a bat there, but I was glad I heard him when he struck Lee Lacy out one day, and Lee was a little off balance and, like, almost falling, and Lee, all he could do was, like, look up at him, and he says, get out of here. And he told him that, like in so many words, to get out of here. And it was like, okay, now he just got there. I mean, we could not sleep one night when we had to face him in Boston. The whole team, we were going to get him. Well, I hadn't hit a home run in a while. I had lost the touch. And I hit a ball in Boston. I had my plan all down. And I just was so mad that I hadn't had that feeling. Like, when I hit him, I knew I got him. I hit it, and I don't know. You know, so you're running. And then once it went out, now I got to say, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? So I got it. I hit third base. I come down, and I start to walk the last 20 feet and do my little Mr. President all the way, you know. And he is ticked off. So now Floyd Rafer gets it. Now, Rafe runs around the base, and we called him Road. Come on, Road. What are you going to do, Road? He's done nothing. He steps on home plate, and he turns around and shoots him up at home plate. And we go, yeah! We are down crushing him this game. So the next day, Jim Rice comes over to us, and he goes, Oh, Ken, I said, don't say that name around me. I said, if he want a message, I said, you tell him to come over here. And when he came over, I then proceeded to tell him about how he pitches. I said, you woke us up And I said, you don't do that. I said, you're out there trying to embarrass people. Now it's on you. And I said, you know what? Let sleeping dogs lie. I mean, you know, you're going out there trying to get people out. And I mean, we already want to get you, but we were
kind of airing him out. Just so you remember, Oil Can was... Wilkin was really flamboyant and stylish on the mound, very energetic, and he'd like poof would dismiss you. So there was a lot of things that that he did that showed us up. And Eddie, whether he was going through a slump or not, this changeup that he had a really good changeup, and Eddie couldn't wait on the changeup. So Eddie did strike out one hand, you know, didn't look good, didn't appreciate it a whole lot. But again, that game in Boston, we knew we had him in a day game, and that was his most mad that I ever saw Eddie, and really to show him up the way he did by taking his hat off in that home play. But it was pretty comical when Rafe shot him down. But
who's your guy?
Here you go. Len Barker was... Len Barker was a guy that has pitched a perfect game in the big leagues, not against us, I don't think, because all you guys could hit him and I couldn't. But my guy, I think I struck out 11 out of the first 12 times I faced him. You know, to me, he had this fastball that was pretty good and it kept you off, and he had a slider that I used to call his invisible slider, because even if you were looking for it, he'd come up there and spin. You go to swing at it, it would disappear and then reappear back here somewhere. And so I remember funny, and this involves Eddie, is, you know, it was bothering me and I was perplexed what adjustment I could make. And it was in a 1-1 game. Len Barker's still in the game in the eighth inning. And I think Richie Dower might hit a double off of him to send Bumbry to third. It was second and third, one out. First base was open. And I haven't made contact against Len Barker, and so now my only job is to make contact to get the runner in. So I waited in that old stadium in Cleveland till Eddie came out of the dugout to come to the on-deck circle so I could ask Eddie for his advice. Now, he was taking his good old sweet time and was walking out there, and I said, Ed, you know, and the umpire was yelling at me to come up to the home plate, and I grabbed some pine tar to kind of put a little additional pine tar on and was kind of stalling him. And I said, Ed, I can't pick this guy up. I can't see him. I can't, you know, do this. I just need to make contact. What should I do? And he said, well, now would be a good time to try something new. And I think, honestly, that was the beginning of my crazy stances. Because I went up there and stood on round home plate. I spread my legs out, and I kept thinking, okay, I'm going to stand right on the plate. I'm going to look for this breaking ball. He is not getting me on this breaking ball. Don't try to pull it. Just try to put it in play. Look for the breaking ball. Look for the breaking ball. Look for the breaking ball. And the pitch came up there, and the first pitch hit me dead in the middle of my back. And I was happy. I ran to first base. And Eddie won the game.
Question right here.
Which do you value more, the World Series championship or getting inducted into the Hall of Fame, and why?
The World Series, by far. I mean, there are a lot of great ball players that never, you know, got the opportunity to win that World Series. That's a complete team thing, and I tell you, it's nothing better than having everybody pull for that one goal. And that 83 team, that 82 season, we lost the last day of the season. And all they told Joe pretty much to do was not to screw it up. You know, it was like pretty much let them alone, they're going to win it. And, you know, those were Earl's words to him. And pretty much that's just all that he did was just keep marking our names in there. But that was just the greatest feeling. I am now coaching with Cleveland. We go into Chicago, and they're showing that 83 White Sox team up there, and I'm going, how did we beat them? I thought we won this. I mean, they had beat. I was second guessing it. The way they had really done their stuff up there in Chicago, and I thought we won that. But it was a really a fun little thing to see from another aspect. Like, they would never show that with the Orioles in town. So I'm with Cleveland, and now I got to see this. Oh, this is how you guys rub it in people's face.
The World Series, by far, the World Series experience. I mean, I like to say I've had a lot of wonderful personal moments, and they're great personal moments that you have when you do something sort of special in a game. The 95, the lap around the ballpark, probably was the best human moment, because you got to share, you know, what you love to do with a lot of people, and personally, and your own family, and you know, it was it took a celebration of 50,000 strong to a more intimate level when you ran around. All those great things. But the feeling you get when you win the World Series, it's the most fulfilling, and it's part of your dream when you're a kid is to not only make it to the World Series, but win the World Series or make it in pro ball. And that last out, I caught the last out and closed my hand around that, and the feeling of completion, fulfillment, is no other feeling, because that's your goal when you step into spring training. And in that particular year, we were solidly focused because of what happened on the last day of 82, and it was evident in spring training. It was evident early part of the season, because I think all of us watched Milwaukee celebrate. We knew we came a game short, and we were thinking, where could we have made that one game up? And we weren't going to let that happen the next year. And then once you actually did it, and then it was final, there was no better feeling that you could have. And so I'm thankful. I thought we were going to be in the World Series almost every year after that. Didn't work out, but I mean, when you look back, you know what it feels like to be world champions, and there's no other feeling like it.
One of the best things about that was to be, you know, I'm there and I'm struggling a little bit. The game before, I get a base hit before the last game, and Richie Dower goes, I mean, after the game, he comes up to me and, you know, we won and everybody's there, and he goes, "How do you feel, kid?" And I look at him, said, "I felt all right." And he left my locker yelling, "The kid's guaranteed it, the kid's guaranteed it." To go up and hit the home run the first time up, you shake everybody's hand, and I sit down. I'm sitting in the middle of the, you know, the dugout there. I look at him and I go, "Richie," I said, "that's not it." I go up and I hit the second, shake everybody's hand, sit down. "Richie, that's still not it." Now, the thing is, I had hurt my wrist, and I could not swing right-handed. I had one swing. Now I'm going up there. I've already told him that's not it. I'm going up, you know. You just were right there that particular day. I go up, and they bring in a left-handed pitcher, and I go, "Oh, jeez." I back out, and I'm standing there and swinging the bats, and I'm trying to get Richie's attention in the dugout. Now I go, "One good swing." I leave the on-deck circle, I go up, the first pitch he throws, I hit it in the upper deck, and it was foul, and I went, "Now I'm going." Because I couldn't use the hand anymore. I mean, it took like, you know, about a good 50 minutes for it to stop hurting. I had one good swing, and that was it, and I hit it foul. I went, "Oh, gee." Now it's like, all right, poke it over there.
Hey, I had to settle for a 2-home-run game, Eddie.
It's kind of funny. You brought back a really good memory for me in the World Series. Is we won the day game the night before, So to put us up 3-1, Saturday game, right? And so, you know, we had the evening to kill before the next game. It was a night game, right?
No.
Was it a night game we won?
No.
It wasn't?
It was a 4 o'clock game.
It was, I remember it was sort of in the evening when it was all over. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing Eddie remembers that too, because my story's about that. So we were going out to dinner. Eddie invited me to go out to dinner with his family, and all his family was there, and it was a really wonderful experience to sit down. It was really relaxing. And Eddie's not much of a drinker, but he does like his sweet drinks. And so, you know, they were flowing pretty well around. And I'm starting to get concerned a little bit here that we're not going to be ready to play. But I think it was exactly what Eddie needed. You know, everybody kind of relaxed a little bit, and we went into the next day. But I remember, you know, that evening with Eddie's family just laughing and talking. I think that really relaxed all of us. And I think Eddie was giggling and got drunk, and he had 2 home runs.
My sisters were.
No, who else with questions? Okay.
They also, one of the most fun things about that 83 season, and I think he vouched for it, was when we won in Chicago. After the game, the bus stopped. You have no idea how a bunch of grown men, there were women on the bus, and we stopped the bus and we had to sing their song to them. Na 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 na. We opened every door, every window, and that was that.
Hey, we've got 4 or 5 minutes left, so here's what I'd like to do. A lot of people have questions. We'll do kind of quick questions, quick answers, so everybody can have a shot at it.
That was God's way of saying you're answering too long, Ed.
Eddie and Cal, is there any advice you can give to this team that is... the Orioles this year... The Orioles this year, are, like in 1979, are probably not picked for, you know, to go to the last game of the World Series. Is there any advice you can give to this team as far as attitude is concerned going into the season?
Quick answers. Remember, Cal?
Yeah, I'm trying to be quick on this one.
I don't speak English.
You know... Try something new. That's right. That's a good answer. I would think, you know, I was impressed with the young nucleus of a couple players in the club last year. And I would just say continue to be yourself and see what happens.
Good answer. Okay.
Is there a player you want to watch today? I mean, is there a player you really like and really like to watch today?
Well, when he's right, when he wants to play. What you saw in Mr. Ramirez is what he is. That was it. I kind of half taught him over in Cleveland, and we went through some stuff there in getting him on the line and hitting. He could already hit, but I tell you, that guy, by far the best RBI guy for a long time. I mean, he's that good.
Got anybody, Cal?
You know, I really enjoy getting to know the Tampa Bay Rays, you know, and maybe that's hopeful for the Orioles coming up, but seeing some of those guys blossom. Longoria's a really good player that comes on. I like to see how he goes about playing. I really enjoyed watching B.J. Upton play center field. You know, he played shallow. I'm looking out there, and I'm looking at this diagram in center field, and that's how I'd want my center fielder to play, is if you're that athletic, don't let any of those bloopers come landing in there, cut the balls off on the angle. You got burned every once in a while over his head, but I tell you what, he caught a lot of balls. He's a pretty special talent.
I don't know how quick this is, but I wanted to know about your trip to China, about what its purpose was and maybe a highlight from that trip.
The trip to China was I was named a special envoy by Condoleezza Rice to represent the United States and spread goodwill. And sports, it wasn't the first time they had started this program, but, you know, they wanted to go spread goodwill over there, and it was just a matter of relating to kids, teaching baseball, and through sport, the walls seemed to come tumbling down. It's no politics and all that kind of stuff. It's really kids being kids and playing with kids. And I really, really enjoyed that experience. Language was a difficult barrier, but it really, you discover how you can demonstrate how you can speak the language of baseball without always having the words to do that. And the formality is one of the things that I did naturally that I didn't know until I left, was when you sit down formally with, say, the Ministry of Sport or the Chinese Baseball Federation, you'd sit down and to a lunch, and they would have food all around a Lazy Susan, and then Lazy Susan would be turned towards you to take food. Now, you have no idea what that food is. And you really shouldn't ask. And so I felt I kept taking whatever was there, and they were kind of watching me, and I ate it readily, and so it was a sign of trust that you're eating and you're with them. I was just hungry.
Right here. You guys have accomplished so much already, but what is something that you guys really, at this point, something that you've set your eyes on that you really want to accomplish now?
I don't think it can be accomplished with three women in the house with you. You never feel like you can relax. I mean, I am learning about little young girls. And they can talk, and they can talk, and they can talk. That's my answer.
I
I don't know what is down the road. I mean, I'm enjoying my life. I love the fact that you can use baseball to kind of spread what dad's we call dad's spirit, his encyclopedia baseball knowledge, and kind of passing that on to help make the game better. Part of the trip to go away to China is to try to improve the game. And I don't really know, you know, that's such a big sort of wide goal. I know that maybe my choices will be a little different when, you know, my daughter went off to college. She's a freshman in college. I have a freshman in high school. And it was really important for me to be there until Ryan gets to be graduate from high school. And when he does, maybe then you can actually take whatever it is, maybe you can come back to the big league game. Maybe you can do something that's totally different than being a player, but help somebody else, you know, kind of be there, be the best that they can be. So.
One reason why I panic so much about my girls is that when I was 21, I had everyone's kid on the team. They were at my lockers. They gravitated to my locker. And I don't know if it was, I was closer to their age or what, but if it was the chant or what, but everybody's kids gravitated towards me. And now I feel what those guys feel. My daughters will not listen to me.
I don't have so much a question as I do a comment, and I want Mr. Gibbons to please take note of the fact that when I first heard about this night and I found out it was $500, I just said, well, that'd be great, but I no way I can afford $500. Well, I have four boys, and I'm here because of them. And I talked with a bunch of other guys here tonight, and I thought I was going to be here with a bunch of rich guys. It just so happens that there's a number of us here that had the same exact thing, that their families, you know, chipped in for them. So we got to do this again. And I'm going to pay for all of them the next time, because it's worth it. It really is.
Thank you.
That's the ultimate compliment there. Final question right here.
What do you remember most about the first spring you didn't report to camp?
You know, upon retirement. Is that the question? Is like all of a sudden, you know, I mean, I was really worried about that, is that when you make the commitment that, or make the decision you're not going to go, and you've done this all these years, what is that first off season going to look like? But an off season looks like the same, especially in the early part of the season before Christmas. You're kind of, you know, letting your body rest, and then you get really serious, you know, more towards January, you start to turn up. And Ed would be serious in April. He would just forget spring training. But I remember thinking, you know, what it's going to be like when they go without me. You know, when they head south, when they get out of the cold weather in February and you go down there. Because I love spring training. It was the most exciting time of the year. You haven't been with your teammates. You go down. You're all goofy like it's Christmas morning. And you're laughing and you're being kind of stupid. But you really, all that behavior was because you wanted to be back together. No pressures. You were just getting in shape. Fans were really close to you. It was really a good time to be in spring training. And I was lucky in my first off season is as soon as I took my uniform off, I had to put another uniform on because I was committed to that project in Aberdeen, you know, and I was on the hook for a lot of money, and I didn't have a team. You know, so I'm authorizing building a stadium, and I don't have a team yet, so I had to go search and find a team and do a lot of stuff and kind of jump through hoops so that when January kind of rolled around, I was already deep in, you know, moving a team to Aberdeen and getting that stadium set up, that I didn't realize that they left. But I did notice the game when it was on TV, and I turned it on, and I felt that you know, I truly was, you know, left behind. And so it's kind of hard to reconcile those sort of feelings, even though you can get as busy as you want and not pay attention. Down deep inside, that's what you did. That's what you love to do.
Yeah, you miss being with the guys, but as a whole, the scariest thing about it, you want to be with the guys, but then you go, oh, that's spring training. I had tougher times. And, I mean, the coaches really, the managers would take care of you as a veteran in these games. But it was like you didn't want to go through spring training. I never had a problem during the season. It was sometimes just getting through spring training. And, you know, I guess that last one was just a little different where I don't know if I was injured or not, but it was more like, oh, got to go through spring training. But you were looking forward to the season. You know, and it was like, let's just forward wind to this.
So you just didn't like the practice, right?
Practice?
Playoffs?
Yeah. No, this game was, it was a lot of fun. I really did. You know what? I really wish you had moved your butt out of the way. I must tell you, I almost retired, and I wish I had at that particular point. I'm in Anaheim. I'm playing with the Angels, and we're playing the Orioles. I never throw the bat. I swung in the bat. And it's sitting out there between home plate and the mound. I never throw the bat. I'm just talking. I'm almost embarrassed to go get it. So I go out there to go get it, and I get it, and oops, the bat was still there. Then I go, something's wrong. And I grab the bat with my left hand, and I walked all the way back to home plate. And I'm going, something's wrong. I'm sweeping at the dirt, trying to delace, and maybe I can get the, you know, something back in this wrist so I can swing. Well, I ended up tearing a tendon on that swing. I hit a one-handed ball. It was two strikes. And he knows that when I get two strikes, I will hit the ball left field. I hit this ball hard with one hand down the third baseline, and he's standing right there. Now, are you talking about could have rode off into the sunset with that? That would have really been neat to do that and then go in and, you know, because I tell you, that's how this car is here. And I just said, maybe that's just enough for baseball right there. And you walk
up. Final thing, I'd like to throw this at both of you, being Hall of Famers and devoting your life to the game. The future of the game, a lot of people say young kids aren't playing baseball. Cal, you work with a lot of youth. Take it forward 25 years. Do you think the game will be in good shape?
I'd like to think it will be, because I have the perspective of seeing the honest love of the game of baseball. I mean, they say the numbers are down a little bit. I think we're growing some of the numbers in many ways around. You're making it more appealing, but the game itself is really appealing to play. And when you see kids do it, you see the fulfillment that comes from that. And the games are on TV all the time. You know, there was some ugliness in baseball that we all had to endure, but it seems like that policy is behind us a little bit, and it seems like we're really focusing on all aspects of the game, which I think is really healthy for all kids, because you don't have to be the biggest and the strongest or throw the ball the hardest. Baseball, there's many opportunities for you to actually bunt, move guys over, slap, play middle infield, and if you start to take out some of those physical elements that really dominated the game, you're starting to see all players that can play the game of baseball and have hope to play it for a long time. So I think it'll be in good shape.
Eddie, for you, you were one of many African-American players that dominated the game, and the numbers of African-Americans in baseball have dropped significantly. Your thoughts on that and the future of the game?
Well, I don't know if those numbers will ever come back. You know, sometimes you got to have players, you know, in that position for them to see, for them to idolize, so that they can identify with. A lot of the inner city fields were in terrible conditions. I think they have tried to fix, go into the inner cities and try and redo some of the fields to make it more, you know, so they would want to come out and play. And, you know, so, you know, you really can't answer that. And, you know, you don't know what kind of program it would take to get them to come back out. Like when I play with the Dodgers, I was telling somebody earlier tonight, as the park director, I had to go there with the Dodgers, and they had an evening at my Little League ballpark. Beautiful ballpark. Beautiful place to play baseball, play tennis, big swimming pool. You're talking about a place where you barbecued all over the park. I mean, it was huge. But nobody's there. And the bad element was kind of there. And I asked the park director to give me took police officers twice a day to just walk the property. You know, I said, then they will know that this is off limits. They can't do this here. And to have the response of nothing, you know, I said, I will make sure that a program gets started here. I will make sure, I will go into the schools to get kids and make uniforms and all this stuff to the point of where they would want to wear this. I mean, and I think that's sometimes how you have to get to some young kids on, you know, they got to look good. And I don't have a problem with that, but they were going to pass classes and things of this nature, but I never got the officers on the ballpark. And the game is going to be all right. I remember when they said the game was going to go broke after, you know, I think Frank was the first one to make $100,000 and stuff. You would like to see, I mean, yeah, the earnings are so quick now. And it's like, well, what are they going to make when they get in their seventh year?
but
that's why we struck. We knew, you know, what we were talking about, and it wasn't that we were going to do a whole lot of benefiting. It was those kids in elementary schools, but we knew we as players were taking a lot of heat for those strikes. But we just knew how big the pie was. We just wanted a little better slice of it because there are so many guys out there that are hurting. You know, like when I tell people my first year, 1977. Anybody here could guess, shut up, Joe and Steve. What was the minimum in 1977? That's close. And he said 2,400. No, it was $19,000. And you know, and when you hear the money, that
meal money.
Today, yeah,
meal money, right?
Meal money today, but you know, it was just, you know, it was really something. And you go back to '73, we're talking about $12,000. And all we were trying to do was to get a bigger piece of the pie. We knew that was there.
You know what mine was? My minimum.
You were rich.
82.
See.
No. That was 1982.
Yeah. Huh? I know it was 82.
No, I think it was like 39.5.
Yeah.
We've come a long way, baby.
Yes, we have.
You guys were born a few years too early. Think what you'd be making today, right?
I think I'm all going to get mad at my mother for having me too early.
Hey. I think the gentleman over here kind of sized up what this evening was about, and I know everybody in this room feels special about these guys, and for us as fans, or me as a broadcaster, to be a part of two of the greatest to ever play the game, and not only what they did between the lines, but what they did as human beings outside the sport. Tonight's a special night. These are special guys. Here's Mike Gibbons.
Ladies and gentlemen, Cal Ripken, Eddie Murray, thank you guys very much. Now, we're going to let Cal and Eddie take a short break, and we'll catch up with them in a few minutes to have our pictures taken. So if all of you can stay here with me for a minute. And, Scott, thank you very much. Thank all of you again. Great night. The mayor's office canceling us. They want to go later. Okay.